I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Later in the program, we'll get reaction to the sentence a judge handed down to Darun Ravi. He is the former student at Rutgers University who streamed video of his freshman roommate, Tyler Clementi, having an intimate encounter with another man. Clementi later committed suicide. Law professor Paul Butler gives his take on the decision. That's next. But we wanted to start today with a personal finance issue that's in the news, and it's also a question that's sure to start a spirited discussion at the dinner table. What's the value of the work homemakers do? To Holly McCall and the thousands of people who've signed a petition agreeing with her, that's exactly the question that's been raised by a new law that's supposed to protect consumers from getting in over their heads in credit card debt. Holly McCall is a stay-at-home mom of two. She tells us she's the one who manages the household budget. She says she's got excellent credit. So imagine her surprise when she was denied a credit card at Target in her own name because she does not have her own individual income. Holly says her denial was based on a rule from a Credit Card Reform Act that went into effect in 2010. It's been interpreted by card issuers to require that individuals without an individual income cannot use household income to apply for a credit card without the permission of the breadwinner. Holly thinks that's demeaning to stay-at-home moms and dads like her, and she's trying to get that rule changed, and she's with us now. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
For another perspective, we've also called Araceli Panameño from the Center for Responsible Lending. That's a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that works to protect homeownership and family wealth by fighting predatory lending practices. Araceli is also a regular on our weekly parenting segment. Araceli, thanks so much for joining us also.
A pleasure to be with you.
So, Holly, tell me how you reacted when you found out that you had been denied.
Well, once I got past the feelings of shock, surprise, and disappointment, I felt pretty motivated. So I decided I needed to figure out how to fix the broken rule that was stopping me from being able to get a credit card in my own name.
Well, you claimed your household income. I mean, because your own individual income, presumably at this moment, is zero or pretty small, right?
So I didn't claim my household income because the application asks very specifically for your individual income.
Individual income.
Right.
So you claimed zero income?
Yes. That was the honest answer to the question.
Did you really expect to get a credit card with zero income?
I didn't, but I had been approved for a credit card in the past since I had been a stay-at-home mother. And in the past, I'd been able to put down my household income. So I was a little bit surprised when I had to answer the question in the way that I did.
Is your objection that there was no opportunity to claim household income, or is your objection that you had to get your husband to co-sign?
It's the implication that I would have to have his permission, although I'm the main financial decision maker, at least on a day-to-day basis in the household, and I have complete access to the income that comes into our household. I think we're fortunate that I'm able to be home with my children, and I feel like I'm being penalized for that.
In fact, you took it to another level. I mean, you started a petition on change.org, and you also apparently went to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And I think you and some of your other folks dressed up in, some 50s outfits to say, this isn't Mad Men, you know, get over yourselves, right?
Yeah, exactly. It really feels like a flashback to about half a century ago where if I want to have a credit card, I need his explicit permission.
What reaction have you gotten to the petition, to your activism around this?
One thing I've discovered is that the authors of the bill, Carolyn Maloney and Louise Slaughter, have actually gone on the record with a letter to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau stating that this is not what they intended for it to have been interpreted as broadly as it has been.
Araceli, we wanted to invite you because you have a slightly different take on this topic. But first, can you remind us exactly of what this Credit Card Act was designed to do? What was it for?
So it was actually designed to offer protections to consumers because in the preceding 10 years, credit card companies and lenders in general had been opening up the spigot of credit. So if you were breathing, they would give you credit irrespective of your ability to repay.
I understand, but what about Holly's point that, in essence, the household income is her income as well, and that the very definition of marriage is that their assets are shared and combined?
So I think that, I hear her frustration. So I'm hoping that we're not asking credit card companies. That would be the last entity I would ask to make a judgment as to the status of a relationship. And so while I hear her frustration, you know, we wanted to make sure that consumers were being treated fairly and that credit card companies were not taking advantage of those that could not fend for themselves. I think that one biggest category of people that would be offered credit, irrespective of their ability to repay, was students. So minor students going to college, they would be bombarded and approved for credit cards, and they had no jobs. And so students would graduate from college with a lot of student debt, and on top of that, a lot of credit card debt.
Holly, what about that point that Araceli is saying that this is meant to protect consumers from getting in over their heads on debt, and that if you don't have an individual income, that from the, let's just take the standpoint of the credit card companies, that it's common sense for them to want to know that the person who does have the income is a willing participant in the agreement to repay this debt. What do you say to that?
It's actually my understanding that the credit card companies opposed interpreting the Credit Card Act in a way that was applied broadly as it has been to the household income change. And it was intended to protect the young adults and the students, which I completely support, and that is not an aspect that I would propose changing. But for a married individual, particularly such as myself, where the income is deposited into a joint account, I have complete access to it. We file our taxes together. Excluding me from being able to consider that my income is demeaning, and it makes me feel like I am not an equal partner financially in the relationship, which I am.
If you just joined us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with Holly McCall. She's a stay-at-home mom of two and was denied a store credit card because of her lack of individual income. She was not allowed to claim her household income. We're talking about that. Also with us, Araceli Panameño from the Center for Responsible Lending. Holly, what about the argument, though, that if you filed your taxes jointly, it's a small step to just have your husband sign the credit card application?
I don't actually have a problem having the discussion with my husband and feeling that we are on the same page. In fact, before I applied for the Target credit card, we discussed that we wanted that for our household. I'm not allowed to speak on behalf of the household is really where I have the issue.
Araceli, what about that? What about Holly's argument that students are different from spouses? You know, if a minor child or even a child who's not a minor who's still in college but is financially dependent on the parents is in a very different position of claiming access to household resources than a spouse. What about her argument?
You know, over 50% of marriages end in divorce. If such event were to happen, Ms. McCall would end up in a worse situation after a divorce, being in a deeper hole with credit that she wouldn't necessarily be able to pay because she hasn't had income.
So, Holly, last week you delivered a petition to the Consumer Federation Protection Bureau. You actually met with the director, Richard Cordray. Do I have that right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
How did that meeting go?
I thought it was a very productive and positive meeting. He and his staff met with us and heard our concerns, and we discussed with a very good collaborative effort what we thought could be potential solutions or how we need to evaluate the scope of this problem. And his staff has taken that away, and in a month, they're going to let us know what they think they potentially could do about this problem.
What can they do? I mean, it's interesting just listening to the two of you. You and Araceli are both intelligent, thoughtful women, parents, with your own life experiences that you're bringing to bear. And I'm guessing that people listening to this conversation are kind of changing sides depending on where they are in this conversation. I'm just wondering, what would be the middle ground here?
I think giving the credit card companies, who really are the experts at assessing the credit risk and the ability to repay, the leeway to consider the household income for certain individuals would be fair, and what that looks like, I think, is something that we'll have to wait and see.
But so for you, this feels as though you are disempowered to speak on behalf of your household. You're not being recognized as an equal partner in the household because the income that is earned for the household is not earned by you.
Right. We made the decision that our household could function comfortably with the single income. And when we made that decision, there wasn't this clause where I couldn't use my household income. And now I feel that that decision is being devalued because I'm not able to speak as a member of the household when it comes to credit now.
Araceli, though, does the perspective of the government or this regulation, how it's being interpreted, isn't this undermining of the whole concept of marriage? I mean, you know, the vows, as I understand them, are for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health. I mean, why isn't this undermining of the whole concept?
So the law is not a statement on marriage or marriage law. The law is a statement of reestablishing ability to repay, which underwriting standards had been thrown out the window. If you could chew gum and breathe, people would issue you credit. In today's market, even if Ms. McCall were to walk into a payday lending shop, whom, you know, which I consider predatory lenders, they would not offer her credit because the first thing that they would ask her for would be evidence of income. And if she doesn't have income, they wouldn't give her a payday loan.
So, Holly, where does this stand now? How badly do you want that card? Are you going to get your husband to sign that application, or are you going to hang tough on this?
I don't want the card badly. Right now, it's really a matter of principle. I think that this is unfair, and so I'm going to work to change it.
Well, to be continued. It's an interesting conversation. Thank you both so much. Holly McCall is a stay-at-home mom from Vienna, Virginia. She says she was denied a credit card despite her impeccable credit because she does not have individual income, and she started a petition on change.org to contest this practice. She was kind enough to join us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Araceli Panameño is with the Center for Responsible Lending. That's a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that works to protect home ownership and family wealth by fighting predatory lending practices. She was with us from her home office in Virginia. Ladies, thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, it's a novel. It's a health and diet guide. It's a sexy take on marriage. Best-selling writer Alice Randall's latest offering is sparking some heated conversations about women and weight, especially Black women. Author Alice Randall joins our diverse panel of moms to talk about the book and her controversial New York Times op-ed. That's just ahead. But first, we want to find out the latest developments in a case that sparked an emotional reaction around the country and some important conversations about privacy, sexuality, and bullying in this high-tech world of ours. It's the story of Tyler Clementi and Darun Ravi. 2 years ago, they were freshman roommates at Rutgers University when Ravi used his webcam to spy briefly on Clementi while Clementi was having an intimate encounter with another man in their dorm room. Ravi also tweeted about it. A few days later, Clementi took his own life. Although Ravi was not charged with having caused Clementi's death, the case was cited by LGBT activists and others as an example of the kinds of intense emotional pressures faced by LGBT youth. In March, Darun Ravi was convicted of several offenses, including invasion of privacy and bias intimidation. He faced 10 years in prison and deportation to India. But earlier this week, Ravi was sentenced to 30 days in jail, as well as probation and community service, and he was fined $10,000. We wanted to talk more about this, so we've called on Paul Butler. He's a professor at the George Washington University Law School. He's a former federal prosecutor. He's been following this case closely, and he's with us now. Paul, welcome back. Thanks for joining us again.
Hey, Michelle. Great to be here.
Of the charges of which he was convicted, what were the most serious?
Invasion of privacy, and that's because Ravi spied on Tyler in his bedroom on two occasions. But bias intimidation, which is kind of like a hate crime, the idea is that he targeted Tyler in part because he's gay. And then he tried to cover up, so witness tampering and hindering apprehension, altogether 15 counts. So he was looking at up to 10 years in prison.
I'm interested in your opinion about this. I'm going to ask you about that in a minute. But during the sentencing, the judge made a distinction between the bias crime that he was convicted of and a hate crime. And he says this distinction is one of the reasons he was only sentenced to 30 days. Can you help us understand
that? It was a somewhat strange comment by the judge because it kind of seemed to discount the jury verdict, which did convict Mr. Ravi of targeting Tyler because he's gay. But what the judge said is it's not like he hated Tyler because he was gay. It was more like a prank that he was very insensitive, but it's not like, you know, when we think of a hate crime, we think of something like what happened to James Byrd, who was dragged on a truck. And it wasn't that. But the judge said, you know, he went on and on about how Tyler, how Mr. Ravi didn't show any remorse. So everybody thought he was going to throw the book at him. But then he comes up with this 30 days, which is a lenient sentence.
You know, it was a very emotional scene in the courtroom. The prosecutor, I think it's fair to say, was visibly upset at the sentence. And the parents, the mothers of both, Tyler Comity was not officially a party to this, but his mother spoke and Darun Ravi's mother spoke. I just want to play a short clip from Tyler Comity's mother.
My question is, why didn't his roommate just request a roommate change? Why was he so arrogant and so mean-spirited and evil that he would humiliate and embarrass Tyler in front of his new dorm mates? The very people Tyler was trying to meet and become friends with. How could they all just go along with such meanness? Why didn't any one of them speak up and stop it?
And I'll now play a clip from Darun Ravi's mother as well. This is also very emotional. Here it is.
As a mother, I feel that Darun has really suffered enough. For the past 2 years, the media's influence on this case is devastating. My 20-year-old son already has too much burden on his shoulder to face for the rest of his life.
Now, the judge said at the time that the sentencing would not make either party happy. That seems to be true. Paul, I'd like to ask your perspective on this. What's your take?
Well, you know, the judge cited Ravi's age. He's just 20 years old. He doesn't have any criminal history. And this wasn't a crime of violence. And importantly, the sentencing officer, the probation officer, didn't recommend any jail time. The judge said, well, I'm going to give him 30 days just because he hasn't shown any remorse. I think it was an appropriate sentence. Again, Mr. Ravi was not convicted or even prosecuted for causing Tyler's death. What he was doing was a prank. It was a stupid prank. But when we think about what college kids do, is 30 days appropriate for a stupid prank? Prank, even one with these kind of tragic consequences? I think probably yes.
It's interesting that this case has sparked such intense feeling across the board. I mean, there are also people who feel that the case was overcharged from the beginning. Of course, it had the tragic casualty, of course, that is never far from anyone's thoughts. And I just wonder if you feel that any precedent has been set here, or are the circumstances so distinct that it's hard to see another scenario to which this might be applied?
Well, a really important conversation is going on. This is the third time that I've been on the show, and we've talked about cyberbullying. We talked about violence against LGBT people. We talked about the importance of free speech and the tension between that and prosecuting people for bias. So, you know, every social problem doesn't have to result in somebody going to prison for a long time. Sometimes there can be other positive consequences. So I think this important national conversation about civil discourse is the most positive thing that can come out of this case.
As we mentioned, the first assistant prosecutor, Julia McClure, told the judge that she would appeal the sentence. Is that what is your assessment? I'm asking you to predict, which is unfair, but what do you think is the likelihood of her being successful?
I predict they're going to lose that appeal. The judge didn't make any error of law. He had the discretion not to sentence any jail time. So there's no real ground. The other interesting thing is that the prosecution originally offered a plea deal with no jail time. So I don't know where they get off now coming and saying that 30 days is too little when they were going to be satisfied with none at all.
Interesting. Paul Butler is a professor at the George Washington University Law School. He's a former federal prosecutor. His latest book is Let's Get Free, A Hip-Hop Theory of Justice. And he was kind enough to join us from our Washington, D.C. studios. And he's been following this case closely, as we said. Paul Butler, thank you for joining us.
It's always a pleasure.
We're switching gears now. You might know Tia Mowry from her days as a teen actress. She starred alongside her identical twin sister, Tamara, on the television show Sister, Sister. Today, she's all grown up and starring in BET's sexy, provocative series, The Game. This will be her last season on the show, where she played medical student-turned-football wife, Melanie Barnett. But behind the scenes, Tia had her own medical drama. She was trying to get pregnant and then conceal her pregnancy with her real-life husband, Corey. How she pulled it off is just one of the tidbits of advice she shares in her new book, Oh Baby, Pregnancy Tales and Advice from One Hot Mama to Another. And Tia Mowry is with us now. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
What gave you the idea to write the book?
Well, the main reason is, you know, when I was pregnant, you know, and especially if it's your first baby, you're anxious, you're nervous, you're scared. And the first thing that you do, you just go out there and you just buy all of the pregnant books that are out there on the shelves. And I just found out that all of them were extremely medically driven, and they just focused on all of the scary stuff that goes on through pregnancy. And I was like, I don't really need to be reminded of this. I'm already scared as it is. I need, you know, someone to just talk to me and just, you know, make me feel like, you know, you're just talking to their girlfriend. And it needed to be fun, informative at the same time. And that's why I decided to write this book, because I felt like that's what was missing.
Well, on the cover, you are actually a very hot mama. You are wearing some killer heels, which even now some of us would have trouble staying upright on. But one of the things that I liked about the book is, first of all, you are very candid about the struggle you had just getting pregnant.
Yeah.
I think that's important, because I think that particularly for women of color, perhaps there is not a lot of literature that even describes the emotional challenge of dealing with infertility.
Yeah.
I wondered if you'd talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. You know, I didn't even know what endometriosis was when my doctor diagnosed me with it. I was having a lot of pain whenever I would, you know, have my menstrual. And I even went to several doctors, and they were like, oh, these are just cramps. And one day I was just having really, really bad cramps that I was really close to calling an ambulance. And I called, you know, my family doctor at the time, and she was like, Tia, just get on the treadmill, take a hot bath, put some heat on it. I'm like, look, I am in pain. So my friend who was staying in the same building, she knew the OBGYN that delivered Will Smith kids, Dr. Dolores Kent. She's amazing. And I saw her, and the first time I just sat down with her, she did an ultrasound, and she's like, I think you have endometriosis.
Well, you know what I'm interested in is, I have to assume you have medical insurance. You certainly have access to health care.
Yeah.
You are a young woman.
Yeah.
And I guess I think that a lot of people might be surprised that there was still so much ignorance around a common medical condition, and one that seems to particularly affect women of color. We're not really quite sure why. What do you make of that?
You know what? I don't know. Like I said, I had no idea what this was. And here I am, a woman of color. And my first doctor, who was just my family doctor, never said anything about it. I had more than one ultrasound. More than one. And she never mentioned it to me whatsoever. And I think, also, when you're young, you're like, well, you know, this is just cramps. So, yeah.
The other thing that you are very candid about in the book was your concern for your career.
Yeah.
Once you became pregnant. And again, I'm really interested in this, because this is an experience that I think other people will have, although it's kind of unique in your case in the sense that, as you point out in the book, you spend a lot of time in lingerie. You know, it's a little different from most workplaces, at least that I've been familiar with.
Yeah.
But it is a challenge that I think a lot of people aren't particularly honest about. And could you just talk a little bit about that? I mean, is it the idea that, you know, if you're not sexy, then you're not employable? What's the issue
here? Well, unfortunately, I will say this. There was this one director that I was working with, and they were auditioning some girls, and I knew who the girl that they were seeing, and I thought she was great, and I was like, why did she not get that role? He specifically told me she did not get this role because she just had a baby.
Now, we've heard this some from other artists, like, for example, Toni Braxton has previously spoken about how the record label that she was with at one time was not aggressive in pushing one of her albums after she had her child.
Yeah.
What is that? Do you think, is this a woman problem? Is this a...
I will be really honest with you.
What is this?
I think for me, you know, because I was a little, I was scared and afraid. But ever since I had Cree, it seems like my career has opened up even more. I wanted to write a book, and they were able to, you know, work everything out so I could write a book. And then right after that, I was able to, you know, do a movie. I just finished doing a movie with Tori Spelling, who just had a baby as well. I think it's harder for women who are viewed as vixens in this business. So if they are seen as these, you know, sexy kittens, you know, and it's harder for men to view them as sexy again, you know, because they just had their baby, which I think is not cool. I feel more sexy. I feel, you know, empowered because I gave life. I have a son now. I feel like I'm stronger.
I am woman, where, hear me roar.
Yeah, I am woman, hear me, and that's what I wrote in my book.
You try this, director.
Yeah.
Not giving people a job, you try this.
But with me, I've always had this, you know, girl next door. You know, I have a very clean image, so I think it's an easier transition.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm joined by Tia Mori. Her new book tells about the joys and the pains of pregnancy. The title is Oh Baby, Pregnancy Tales and Advice from One Hot Mama to Another. So let's get to some of the fun parts. What was the best thing about being pregnant? What was the worst?
I think the best thing about being pregnant would definitely have to be seeing just my belly grow and seeing, like, wow, there is, you know, something inside of me, really, no matter what I do, it's going to be working. Like, just, you know, it's unbelievable how the human body is. The worst part about pregnancy would definitely have to be my nausea. I don't know why it's just called morning sickness, because morning sickness never just happened in the morning for me, and it's not happening just in the morning for my sister. She's pregnant 4 months right now. Mine happened in the morning, afternoon, and in the evening, and not only did it just happen in the first trimester, it happened throughout my whole entire pregnancy. I'm like, dang, how come nobody told me about this?
Well, that's why you have this book now.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about your career now. When you have a lot of fans on the game. What is it about that series that you think connected with people?
One thing that I love about the show, number one, is it focuses on women and, you know, women who are powerful, women who are successful. But also, these women were real and relatable. And one thing in particular that I loved about my character was it showed her flaws. Not everybody is perfect. Everybody goes through certain journeys, you know, within their lives. And they showed that. This show also talks about things that a lot of people don't talk about. We talked about infidelity and, you know, baby mama drama. You know, we talked about realistic stories, I think, that women go through and that we overcome.
And now you're working on a reality show with your sister, yes. Your twin, Tamara.
Yes.
I understand that that's actually going very well, too.
Yeah.
It's a top-ranked show on Style Network. Yeah. What do you think people are interested in with that?
For some reason, I think people resonate with my sister and I because we're real people. We're honest. And then also they feel like they grew up with us and we're hilarious.
What's your best bit of advice for somebody who's maybe just starting on this journey?
The one advice that I would give just to moms who have a child or a newborn is definitely sleep while the baby sleeps. I've heard that so many times. I never realized how true it really is. If you don't, you'll be walking around like a zombie. The other thing is, as a new mom, trust your instincts. It's embedded in you. We were created, I think personally, for this. We were born to just know really what to do. For women who are pregnant, sometimes when you're pregnant, everybody, especially your mother-in-law, your whatever, sister-in-law who's already had kids, they kind of want to throw all of their ways on how they had a child, whether that's make sure you breastfeed or make sure you don't get an epidural. You know, it's up to you. This is your baby. You have the right to do whatever you want. And if you have a mother-in-law that's constantly pointing her finger, don't argue with her. Just smile and nod and just say, okay, thank you, because you don't want to get into an argument. You're pregnant. You don't need to be stressed.
Bring out your inner Tia.
Right? Yeah.
Tia Mori is an actress. She joins her identical twin on the Style Network's Tia and Tamara. She was kind enough to join me in our Washington, D.C. studio to talk about her book, Oh Baby, Pregnancy Tales and Advice from One Hot Mama to Another. Tia, thank you so much for joining
us.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms in your corner. Every week, we check in with a diverse group of parents for their common sense and savvy advice. Today, though, we're taking a book break. There's a holiday weekend coming up, and we thought you might be looking for something to tuck into that bag you're taking to the pool or the beach, or just to keep you company while the grill warms up. The moms are joining us to talk about the new book, Ada's Rules, a sexy, skinny novel by Alice Randall. Ada is a preacher's wife who's taking care of everybody else, the congregation, her husband, her elderly parents, his elderly parents, her children. She's managing, but an invitation to her 25th college reunion pushes her to take a hard look in the mirror, and she does not like what she sees, especially that 100 pounds she's gained since college. The story follows Ada as she tries to take control of her weight and her life, and Alice Randall is with us now. She's also the author of the bestseller, The Wind Done Gone. She's a writer in residence at Vanderbilt University. She's also a best-selling country music songwriter. Sorry, I just had to throw that in. And she's a wife and mom. We're also joined by three of our regular Moms contributors, Jolene Ivey. She's a state lawmaker in Maryland and the mom of five. Leslie Morgan Steiner is an author, most recently of Crazy Love and a mom of three. Danny Tucker is an office administrator, a freelancer, a mom of two, and a part-time fitness instructor. Welcome, ladies, moms. Thanks
hey,
for joining
Michelle.
Us.
Thank you.
Great to
hey.
Be here. So, Alice Randall, what inspired you to create this character?
I created Ada in response to my own journey of recognizing one day I woke up and realized I was over 225 pounds, and as a mom, not the role model I wanted to be for my daughter, who was still fit, but I thought she might not always be if I stayed as big as I was.
You know, the people have, in fact, one of the blurbs on the book by Pearl Klieg, the wonderful writer, said, well, is this a novel disguised as a diet book, or is this a diet book disguised as a novel? It's a very interesting, you've got some very interesting ideas embedded in the novel about fitness, about what weight means in each culture. I'm very curious about how you kind of came up with that approach.
Well, throughout my novels, my first novel, Wind Done Gone, was a diary. My second novel was either a love letter or a suicide note. This one is Ada is writing her own diet book. She's thought about writing a children's How to Raise Your Children manual. Instead, she writes a diet book. And in it, I capture the best of science and wisdom that I had come across that helped me get from way over 200 pounds to significantly under. But it's basically, but I love experimenting with different forms, and diet books are a form of literature that many people read, and cookbooks are a very important form of literature. So I thought it was wonderful to just to part of the spirit of play of the whole book, of taking a serious subject but engaging it playfully, was to playfully write, have Ada write a diet book.
And it is a lot of fun. Jolene, you are weight does not seem to ever have been an issue with you in all the years that I've known you, but you told us that despite that, you really identified with Ada.
Well, for a number of reasons. One is, of course, every woman in America at least worries about her weight. I don't care how big or small you are, you're always thinking about it just because it's our culture. And I certainly have my own struggles. I just don't let it go so far, you know. I figure if I'm 5 pounds overweight, well, it's a lot easier to lose the 5 than it would be to 50. So I just try to attack early. But beyond that, when I look at her life, I mean, she's overwhelmed. She's got too much going on, and so do I. So I can totally relate to what she's with the struggles that she has.
Well, it's also just some of the points of comparison we've talked about on the program. You are a state lawmaker yourself, but your husband was also a public official. There was there was a time in which you were kind of the first lady in that role.
Right.
And then you're both public officials and you got kids and you're caring for elderly parents as well.
Well, so at least
until recently.
You know, when my dad passed. But so, up until, you know, February, I was taking care of him too. So between the elderly parents, the kids, of course, her kid's a little bit older than mine, and, you know, everything else you have going on, the expectations from the community, she wants to look good and she wants people to like her. And, of course, everybody feels that way. Hmm. So I think there's something here for everybody.
Danny, what about you? Did you relate?
Oh, totally, because Ada is every woman in my Zumba classes. I teach 3 Zumba classes, and the sisters are, and they relate a lot to Ada because they also struggle with the thick and fit part of it, you know.
Talk about thick and fit.
Well, because black men like their women thick, you know, and, you know, it's that gray area of, you know, if I get a size 4 or 5, am I too small, or, you know, is it okay to be thick and fit? And I teach my sisters it's okay to be thick and fit. You can still be a size 12 and be fit, you know.
But do you have folk in your Zumba classes saying, I don't want to get too skinny?
Oh, yes. I'm one of them, and I'm the teacher. No, I do not want to get too skinny. I like my curves. I love my curves. And we teach them, and I teach in my class, to embrace your curves. Many of us are not going to get that skinny, so get over it. You know, I tell them all the time, last time I was that small, I was born. It ain't happening, you know.
Okay.
But, you know, but it's
I love
okay.
you.
I love you, too.
And she looks good, too. But, you know, Leslie, you were telling us that you were really taken by the cultural piece because you are, as you don't mind sharing, white. And you were saying that you've never heard anybody say, a white woman, a white friend of yours say, "It's I don't want to get too thin." In fact, there's that famous phrase that attributed to Wallace Simpson, the Duchess of Windsor, that you can never be too rich or too thin. Tell me more about that.
Well, reading the book, you know, every time one of the black characters would say, "Now, Ada, don't get too skinny," I would laugh or kind of feel like crying too, because I, in my whole life, have never heard a white person, male or female, say to me or anybody else, "Don't get too skinny." And I think it would be wonderful to be more comfortable with being normal or even being overweight. And it really made me think so much why white women are so ashamed of being fat and why black women seem to have that part of the equation more balanced, more figured out. Although it's really complicated because being fat is unhealthy, but so is obsessing about your weight and dieting and thinking that, you know, you're not, no one can love you if you're overweight. I mean, that's just as crazy and just as unhealthy. And that's the world that I live in as a white woman.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Our moms are having book club today, and we're talking about the new book, Ada's Rules. It's by the best-selling novelist Alice Randall, and three of our regular moms contributors, Danny Tucker, Leslie Morgan Steiner, and Jolene Ivey, are talking about it. Ada follows the story of Ada. She's a preacher's wife who's trying to get her weight and the rest of her life kind of in more balance and on the right track. And Alice Randall, you talk about, we talked a little bit about the structure of the novel, and there really are rules. And some of them are really fascinating to me. And you talk about things that I don't often see connected to the discussion around weight loss, like getting enough sleep.
You know, that is key. It is turning out that science is suggesting, there's a wonderful Harvard sleep study, that exhaustion is actually the unexamined culprit in many cases of obesity. And you really need to get 8 hours a night, particularly if you've ever gotten to be significantly overweight. The 8-8-8, walk 8 miles each week, sleep 8 hours each night, and maybe drink 8 hours, 8 glasses of water each day, is Ada's key. But sleep is the culprit, and it's the problem with me. I only get 5 hours a night sleep almost all of my life. That's how my life works, how I got to write, publish 4 books in the last decade and raise a daughter. But it also is part of what got me to over 225 pounds. It's the part I struggle with the most daily now.
Don't forget all those country music songs. You know, I'm going to keep bringing that up. I just love that idea. You know, Alice was like the first African-American woman to pen a best-selling country music song. Woo-hoo. Did you know that?
That's
so she
great.
Had to squeeze that in somewhere along the way, too. But you know, Alice, you also sparked this controversy with this New York Times op-ed earlier this month where you wrote, quote, "Many black women are fat because we want to be," unquote. And your take was this, you know, you talked a little bit about the, what was it, Danny? Thick and fit. That's kind of the thick and fit. Did you get a lot of pushback on that? I got the impression that there were a lot of people who said absolutely true, and that there were some people who really did not appreciate your talking about that. What was your take on the response?
Well, the letters I got to my home, I got hundreds of letters saying, like one I have right in front of me, "I too grew up in the era of Joe Tex and prayed for more pounds on my bony frame. They never came and I made peace." And I also did get some pushback, but mainly I realized this is just such a painful topic for so many women. And I was so glad that I wrote the novel and wanted to get off the facts and into the fiction that can make this all more joyful and playful, that I realize that we have so much to share with each other about what is our wisdom and how. And Ada is so quick to jump in there and be creative once she takes on the problem. But largely, the letters I got to my home were overwhelmingly saying, "You told one of my stories.
Mm-hmm.
You told a part of my life." And I also know it looks so different. I write and live in the Stroke Belt. I live in Tennessee. My daughter lives and teaches in Mississippi. My father's family is from Alabama. And as I said to one of my beautiful sisters up in New York, who wanted to talk about fat McDonald's making black people
heavy. I said, there is no McDonald's in Louisville, Mississippi. There's more to it than that. Mm-hmm. But that is also a problem. So I'm so glad that we have so many voices at the table. And I'm so glad that on a day like this, we're focusing on what we have in common and how all of us can come together and attack this problem and engage with this problem playfully and joyfully, because it has to be engaged.
I was just going to bring Jolene into this, because you've dealt with this both as a lawmaker and as a parent, and also just as a mom, as a person yourself. But you experienced that. I mean, you've shared that, you know, your hubby has expressed to you that he would like you not to be too thin.
From the very beginning, when we first started dating, he told me a couple of things negative about myself, and one of them was that I was too thin. And I was like, well, that's your problem. That's not my problem, because I don't really care what anybody else thinks. I want to be comfortable in myself. And he still wishes that I weighed a few more pounds, but we've been married, you know, almost 24 years now, so I guess he's not going anyplace.
Shall we share with him some things we'd like him to change?
Not on the air, please.
Will you get busy with that letter? Leslie, what about you? Tell us also what struck you about that. Were there things that you did also identify with in the book?
Yes, there was a lot I identified with. One of the funny things is that actually tomorrow I'm going to my 25th college reunion. So it's been a time of reflection, and I really identified with Ada looking at herself and trying to figure out what she wants out of life. And what struck me quite a bit was her and my own and many women's inability to see ourselves clearly, to see our strengths, to appreciate our own beauty at any age, to make peace with ourselves, and to lose weight as she does in the book, or somehow to get healthy and take care of yourself for yourself, not for your husband or kids or society, or to look good at your 25th reunion. And I loved that message of the book. It was really empowering to me.
Danny, one of the things that I also liked about the book, I have to be honest, is the fact that Ada had to figure out not just how to fit fitness in, but also how to pay for it. You know what I mean? She had to figure out, well, I can't just go out and buy a treadmill. I can't just go out and redo my wardrobe. You know, she's running a daycare center, and as we should, she's a preacher's wife. They're trying to be fiscally responsible and transparent with the congregation. And I bet that, you know, resonated with you. One of the solutions you found is to do what?
To teach Zumba now instead of just taking it. I mean, 85 pounds ago and 3 years ago, that was my biggest problem. How do I do it as a single mom on you know, and not making a lot of money? And, of course, she started by walking. And, you know, I learned to start with, well, all of these ladies to start with. Ada started with what she knew, walking. Mm-hmm. And, okay, I know how to dance. You know, some I know how to do and get myself moving. And you take it from there. And then, you know, and nowadays, to be honest with you, there are some affordable things out there. I had to look for them. $10 gym memberships for the month. They're out there. Didn't know that, you know. And then after taking so many classes, I said, well, you know what, I'm going to teach and make me some money, and then teach other women. I have like 4 of my students now who are now certified instructors. You know, and it's about just motivating. My mom will be a certified. She's one of my students, and she will be a certified Zumba instructor in August.
I'm scared of her.
Can't find a beat. Not if you gave her one, but she does her thing. And
but she's in Ada's army. I want all of that. Those are members of Ada's army.
We are all members of Ada's army, and I love it because we do it together. And that's the thing I like about the book. Ada shared her story, and when women can identify, they realize they're not alone. That's the biggest thing, just knowing that you're not alone.
Alice, I was cracking up, though. Some of the rules, there are rules, and the book is titled Ada's Rules, and Ada has a lot of rules. I just want to read a couple of them. Curious about your favorite. Don't keep doing what you've always been doing. Weigh yourself daily. Get therapy. Don't initiate things you can't stick with for 5 years. Seize the power props, scarves, shoes, purses, sunglasses, and respect. Yeah, just pick anyone and tell me about the inspiration, or just tell me something about one of those rules. If you have a favorite one I didn't cite.
Well, I love massage your own feet. That's rule 30. And what I love about that is it's free. And it's an immediate self-help. Instead of reaching for something to eat or getting a little, you take care of yourself in a brand new way. Because I think that's Ada's adventure is to, with all her practical challenges, how to improve her life and not make this shape-shifting about deprivation, but actually about adding wonderful new things like Zumba into her life or a walk. I love that it's practical, that the thing about all the ones that you've said they're practical and easy to do. So some of the other ones, the harder ones, are even consider surgery. She's not advising people do it, but consider it.
I also, of course, being a country songwriter, love self-medicate with art. I think your iPod can you be your best friend if you know enough, like Ada, to create a playlist that is going to chill you out or lift you up. If you've got that ready, that's a perfect part of anybody's emergency kit.
You don't talk about an emergency kit in the book. Talk about what is an emergency kit, very briefly.
Well, life is going to give you one moment when your daughter calls with some huge problem, or you know you're running out of money, or someone's bounced a check, and you need to have a new way to react. You need to have something that's going to lift your spirits right then, or chill you out, or give you the moment. And it can be as simple as a postcard that you've picked out of something, a picture you love that's in your purse, and it's music. It's planning in advance for those hard moments, including sometimes of just weighing yourself daily, and you pick that rule. A lot of women, particularly if they're seriously overweight, weighing yourself daily may actually help you keep on plan and actually up your metabolism. It's not for sure, but something to play with. And we surely don't, any of us, need to be afraid of a number on a scale.
Okay. Well, I like medicate with art. Can we slip NPR in there? Medicate with,
yes,
with NPR?
Absolutely.
Medicate with Tell Me More.
Medicate with Tell Me More. Alice Randall is the author of the new book, Ada's Rules, a sexy, skinny novel. It is sexy. I did want to mention that. I'll just throw that in there. She is also...
Skinny is comfortable in your own skin.
That's right. She's writer in residence at Vanderbilt University, and she was kind enough to join us from the campus there in Nashville. Leslie Morgensteiner is an author most recently of Crazy Love. She was with us from New Hampshire Public Radio. We caught up with her while traveling. Jolene Ivey is a Maryland state lawmaker and a mom of five. Danny Tucker is a freelancer, a Zumba instructor, and a mom of two. They were both here in Washington, D.C. Ladies, moms, thank you so much.
Hey, thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Alice.
And that's our program for today. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.